Good evening. It's this Panacea, your health pro, coming out every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. I'm Quentin Strawley. We look at Food Allergy Week. We look at the how we resolve blocked fallopian tubes. Have a look at the advantage of cinnamon, breastfeeding, and also look at the dangers of plastic. We're screwing up the atmosphere and the environment. All that coming up in the next half hour, so please stay tuned. Now, apparently it's Food Allergy Week, and I've listed a story from The Daily where he was talking to Melanie Gripes earlier on in the week.
I'm being joined by renowned nutritionist Melanie Gripes. She's currently involved with Enjoy Life, a new range of food and snacks designed for people with food intolerances. Now, I'm kind of curious, how common are food allergies in the real world?
Well, particularly common in Australia. In fact, we currently hold the title of the country with the most food allergies. So we have about 1 in 10 babies being born with some type of allergy or intolerance now. So the rate's huge.
That is huge. How do these get recognised? When do we start noticing food allergies?
Well, most commonly in little ones. So when we're introducing foods to babies, when they're trialling their first foods, and even sometimes during breastfeeding or when a baby is starting on some type of formula feed. So it can be pretty early on. And sometimes people do grow out of it, usually by the age of about 4.
So that's if it's going to go away, that's when it's going to go away.
Yeah, that's right. If you haven't outgrown it by the age of 4, then you've probably got it for the rest of your life. And it depends a little bit if you're talking about an allergy or if you're talking about an intolerance as well. Because what I find I'm seeing so much of now in my clinic is people who are developing intolerances later in life.
And how are these different to allergies? I mean, is it giving the same effect?
Yeah, it can be really confusing for people because you often get the same types of symptoms. So an allergy actually impacts upon the immune system, and so it's an immune system reaction, and that's where you can get the anaphylactic reactions and possibly, can
bad
lead
things,
to
even
death. Yeah, that's right. Whereas an intolerance is a digestive problem, so the foods aren't being digested properly, and they're the things that can be developed much more commonly by adults. But both of them, the clients that I see, it can be just awful. Some people literally get to the point where they can't leave the home anymore because they're so scared of going out because they can't, if they don't know where a toilet is, they just won't be able to, won't be able to function. People have to wear pads if they're going out in public, and sometimes multiple pads. And for some people it just means that they can't go out to different restaurants with their friends because it impacts upon, they're scared of going out for a meal and then ending up burping or farting and embarrassing themselves in front of their friends.
Well,
it can really impact people's lives.
It can. I was going to say, it's not just about being a bit fussy about your toast at a cafe. I mean, this is a real world effect for people.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I've found challenging as a dietitian is that now that we have got so much trendy sort of, gluten-free has kind of become a trend for some people, and some people think that it can can help with weight loss and so forth, which the research shows that it doesn't. Then what happens is that it can be really confusing for hospitality staff, and so people who really do have severe allergies don't, the restaurant staff aren't actually as aware, and they don't realise that some people, even the tiniest little bit of that type of allergen, can set off either an anaphylactic reaction or exacerbate celiac disease, or really send people to terrible symptoms. And so, so they're not sort of getting that same respect as what once upon a time they were.
It's interesting. I mean, a lot of your media career must be around myth-busting some of this stuff, surely.
Yeah, tend to do a lot of myth-busting these days, yes.
Do we know what the most common food allergies are? I mean, everyone hears about peanuts, but is that sort of the big one?
Yeah, look, it probably is the big one. Probably the main reason why we hear so much about peanuts is because it's the one that tends to cause the most anaphylactic reactions, so it's the most life-threatening. And, you know, we see so much of it in kids these days, and that's why so many schools are now banning peanuts. And so, you know, it is a real problem. And it can be really difficult for mums as well, mums and dads as well, who are trying to pack school lunch boxes, because a lot of schools are now saying that you have to have allergen-free snacks.
Wow.
And so that can cause an extra level of difficulty when you're packing your lunchbox.
Now, it is Food Allergy Awareness Week. For adults who kind of do feel a bit dodgy after certain foods, if they're thinking they might have an intolerance or maybe a looming allergy, is there a way to test?
Look, there is. So particularly with intolerances, we do what's called a hydrogen breath test. So that's where you go on a special diet overnight or for about 24 hours, and then you go and you basically blow into this machine, and it reads your breath outputs of hydrogen.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, but the thing is that it's not as accurate as what we call an elimination diet. So the gold star best way to test is to go and see a doctor or a dietitian. So a dietitian to test for intolerances and an allergy specialist doctor to do the immune testing, the IgG testing.
That was Melanie Gripes talking to The Daily Programme.
Sydney Film Festival is now on sale. There's over 350 screenings of 288 films from 62 countries over 12 days in 10 venues. From the magnificent State Theatre in the city to the Ritz Cinema in Randwick, there's bound to be a film and a venue just right for you. It all happens from June 7 to 18. You can buy your flexi passes or single tickets right now at sff.org.au. Sydney Film Festival, proudly sponsoring 2SER 107.3.
Now, the big dilemma we seem to have in this world of ours is, in fact, plastic. Here's a story of actually how encumbered we are by the very nature of it.
Because the reality is, plastic is everywhere, from our phones to our plates, as well as medical packaging. It's been rooted in our lives, and it's hard to reduce its usage. But the main purpose for most of these plastic items are actually only for single-use things, and most don't ever see a second life due to a failure in recycling them. These items might get lost in the trash or thrown out in the street because most damage to our environmental health. This is known as plastic pollution. These plastic items are not only causing major problems in our environment, but also take hundreds of years to decompose. In fact, it's been estimated that around 300 million tons of plastic is produced globally, and only 10% of it gets recycled per year. The ones lost are not even accounted for, and it will take centuries in our environment to decompose. So why are plastics so hard to decompose? Here with us to explain more on the plastic life and how to make a difference is Ali Leclerc, from sustainability consultant from VegWare. Welcome on the show, Ali. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Ali, we'll start with the most obvious question. I suppose, why are plastics so hard to decompose?
Well, the thing is, they've been gone through a chemical process that is not natural, so it's really hard for organisms that usually decompose your food and other things like that to identify this type of chemical components in this new item, so it's just impossible for them to degrade them.
Of course. Now, these are particularly bad for the environment, it being known as plastic pollution. So how detrimental is it? And, you know, what are the kind of effects on the environment that are particularly detrimental?
Well, it's terribly bad because the environment cannot absorb it back. So the thing with plastic, it will break down probably into very small pieces, which then will end up in the oceans or into the land. So it will create a huge amount of contamination. For example, fish, they will eat all these small plastics and they can get killed because of it.
Indeed, which, you know, we never want to see animals killed needlessly, I'm sure. Now, are plastics actually more harmful to our environment or to our bodies? Because it seems like the two are, you know, almost competing for a prize no one would ever want.
Well, I think for both of them, it's just as harmful, you know, because if you put it into the environment, it will kill all the animals and all non-human species. But then if you give it to a human, it will be just the same thing.
Indeed. I suppose part of the challenge for this plastic pollution, I suppose it's not linked to climate changes and it doesn't cause climate change, but it does cause environmental harm. With those two issues, I mean, do they ever kind of cross paths at all, the idea of plastic pollution and climate change pollution or carbon pollution?
Well, I think it does, because if you think about it, plastic is made out of fossil fuels, which is a non-renewable resource, and is one of the main reasons why we have climate change.
Now, biodegradable and compost-ready items, for a want of a better word, there's actually a difference between them that not many people kind of understand or appreciate. I actually didn't know this until you just told me before going on air about the difference between biodegradable items and compost-worthy items. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So if a product is biodegradable, it means that it will degrade into very small pieces. There is no time frame for it, so it can be a couple of weeks, it can be 500 years. There are no industry standards for that.
Okay, wow. So that's quite a range there, from a couple of weeks to 500 years. I suppose, how harmful does that then become to the problem? I mean, are biodegradable products kind of part of the problem as well then?
Oh, absolutely. When something is biodegradable, you might lead a consumer to think they're doing the right thing when they're really not. They're just creating a different type of waste.
Are there any types of products in particular that appear as biodegradable but do take a long time to decompose?
Well, there are some companies that make, for example, if you see something that says, oh, this is 70% biodegradable, it means that the other 30% is not. So that is just as bad as having a regular item, because it's just absolutely impossible to separate those type of materials into the waste stream.
Okay, and what is the process of a biodegradable subject actually breaking up and kind of biodegrading, I guess?
Well, it just degrades. It breaks down into very, very small pieces. It might leave a toxic residue. So let's say if you put it into the landfill or if you try to compost it, it might be detrimental for the plants and the land where you're placing it.
Okay. Now, I want to speak a bit more about this idea of plastic. You said 90% of it doesn't get recycled. So what happens to that? Does it go through a process of decomposition? Or, I mean, how does it all happen?
No, it doesn't really decompose. Well, it might decompose, but it will take forever to do so. It will pretty much just end up in the landfill or get incinerated. One of the main issues why plastic doesn't get recycled, is, especially in the food industry, is because it gets contaminated. So if you have plastic with food, you cannot process it, and vice versa.
And what should the kind of average John citizen do if they want to try and be able to change, you know, their own practices around this stuff?
Well, you know, if you cannot really ban plastic from the world, I don't think plastic is the whole problem. It's the way we use plastic. So if, you know, if it's a product that's meant to last for 500 years, why would you use it in a product that is meant to be used for 15 seconds?
That was Ali Leclet explaining the dangers of plastic.
I guess I'll have to change my plan.
On May 27, you may well have to change your plans if you don't want to miss the 2SER Bob Dylan Birthday Marathon. 2SER's celebration of all things Bob will go for 8 hours and feature news, reviews, interviews, the Bob Dylan quiz, and all the Bob songs that fit, starting at 8 p.m. and going through till 4 in the morning. The Bob Dylan Birthday Marathon on 2SER, May 27, from 8 p.m. 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music, and Bob.
It's a hard rains are gonna fall.
Now, I know cinnamon has often been used for flavouring, but in fact, if you listen to the latest research, it actually may help us therapeutically as well. Let's turn to a regular contributor, Russell Setright, who's a practising naturopath in New South Wales. Russell, tell us all about cinnamon.
Well, this is interesting. It's an animal study, but it follows on human studies, so it's not like it's just isolated. This one found that cinnamon given to with equal diets of fatty-type diets reduced the amount of belly fat that the animals put on, which is, of course, associated with cardiovascular disease and strokes, because it's the bad fat they have on you.
Yeah.
You know, there's a number of reasons. We do know that some studies have found cinnamon helps normalise blood sugar levels. We do know that it has protecting effect in antioxidants and anti-inflammatory effects. So it's got a number of ways it could help, and they think that maybe it affects how we store fat as well. Right. Now, we know the protein can have that effect as well. High calories from protein is stored more as muscle than belly fat, whereas carbohydrates stores it more as belly fat. So I think they need to look at it more, but I don't know what a cinnamon sandwich is like. I like a bit of cinnamon, but, you know, the exact dose of it, difficult to find out. I've found about half a teaspoon a day in some of the studies seem to be what they said, but no one's really done a long-term 10-year study of having half to one teaspoon of cinnamon a day, so we don't know that. But what we do know is that it does seem to have some health benefits, and maybe a little bit of it every now and then might be a good idea.
Well, I know in the States I've had difficulty in eating a whole cinnamon sandwich, which has been given to me before now.
Same here, a bit rugged.
Yes, that's right. But also, do we, if we're going to be eating cinnamon, we've got to take the fat to where to work, of course. So we've got to actually get one habit to deal with a bad habit.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. But it's interesting to see that they're doing more work on some of the old herbal remedies. Cinnamon was, you know, used as a herbal remedy as well.
Yeah.
But going back on the research, as I said, there is some fairly good studies to say that it can help with glucose, glycogen transfer, therefore can help with diabetes. So, I mean, that's pretty good. So maybe it's one of those herbs that's a bit like parsley. You wouldn't have a parsley sandwich, but a little bit of sprig of parsley is not too bad.
Well, parsley is full of calcium anyway.
That's right, but yeah. It's a bit rugged in taste if you want to have a whole sandwich of it, isn't it, to me? Anyway.
So, historically, what was cinnamon used for from a point of view of herbalist?
Well, I think anti-inflammatory effects, and this is what they have found, and that it had anti-inflammatory and antioxidant properties, and that may account for some of its benefits in helping reduce the heart disease, apart from the fat, preventing oxidisation of fats and that type of thing, the build-up on the artery wall. So, you know, that's one of its positive studies that have found that, and they again mentioned that as well, which was in some of the past studies.
Well, I'm just thinking about when I'm actually got stuff on the grill or on the barbecue, you could actually make a cinnamon sauce to go onto it.
Well, you could, couldn't you? You know, I don't mind a bit of cinnamon toast. I think that's quite nice, as long as you don't have too much of it. But, you know, the amount that I looked up to find out someone who, they were talking about that half a teaspoon, well, spread over the day, that wouldn't be a problem, but in one hit, I think it'd be a bit rugged.
I think it would. Oh, well, interesting. We have to expand our dietary intake to help us deal with the fat. I've been talking to Russell Setwright, who's a practicing naturopath in New South Wales, who joined us most weeks. Russell, you have a really good week, and we'll catch up next.
Thanks very much, Glenn.
World-renowned scientist, humanitarian, conservationist and UN Messenger of Peace, Dr. Jane Goodall returns to Australia with her message of hope for the future. Think Inc. and the Jane Goodall Institute Australia invite you to enjoy a rare opportunity to witness her on stage on June 23 at the Horden Pavilion. Info and tickets at thinkinc.org.au. Sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Since 1917, doctors have performed a technique which involves flushing the fallopian tube to diagnose and help with infertility. It has been purely a diagnosis technique, but with recent study shows that it could actually improve fertility. This technique could help tens of thousands of women avoid the need for and also the extensive cost of IVF. So how does this procedure work? The Daily was joined by one of the researchers behind the study, Robert Norman, a professor of reproduction in the University of Adelaide.
Now, looking at this particular technique, I want to try and get this one, the hysterosal pingogram. What does it actually involve?
So it's a rather old-fashioned technique whereby dye is injected through the woman's fallopian tubes from through the vagina, and an X-ray is taken to make sure that the dye is actually coming out. So it's been in use for more than 100 years, and there have been different chemicals used to visualize the tube. And over the past two or three decades, we've moved away from oil-based treatment to water-based because they appear to be safer. But there's always been the suggestion that pregnancies might be improved by using an oil-based system. So this is the first study. study to definitively show that using an oil-based flushing not only tells us the state of the tubes, but induces pregnancies in a large number of people in the months that follow.
So how would it work? I mean, if we use this technique to induce a pregnancy, how would that actually occur?
There are a number of theories, none of which are proven. The first is that one could envisage the kind of plugs of mucus within the fallopian tube that stop the egg and the sperm getting together. And there's just a physical flushing of those mucus plugs. The second is that it irreversibly changes the lining of the womb so that when an embryo turns up, it's more prone to implant. And the third is that it somehow changes the immune system so that any embryo that's around is accepted rather than rejected.
If this sort of technique's been around since 1917, we've been using it for the last 100 years, and these theories have been floating around for a while, why is it that this is the first study that's actually come up with these kind of results, these kind of results that would go towards proving those theories?
Well, I think the thing is that we in medicine often have theories that certain things work or don't work. But until we actually do proper, well-conducted research trials, you can never be absolutely sure, because it just depends on one person saying, this is my experience, and that's not very reliable.
Mm.
To do a research trial needs a lot of money, and you need a grant to do that, and costs several million dollars. So until you can convince people who hand out the money to finance a study like this, you'll never be absolutely sure. And now we are sure. Before that, people who said, look, we think it works, they were right, but we didn't have enough evidence to move that way.
Mm. So looking at some of the costs and some of the uncertainties around IVF, how would this compare? If this was to, essentially, this study proves these theories, it comes up with some ways of implementing it as a procedure to improve fertility, how would it stack up compared to IVF?
It's probably about one-tenth of the cost of going through an IVF
one-tenth.
Cycle.
Wow.
And it has long-term effects, so that it's going to be repeatable in subsequent months. So it's certainly very cost-effective. And the other great thing is it can be ordered by any general practitioner, and it can be done by any radiology department. One doesn't need to go to a fertility clinic to get it. But I do want to emphasize that the only people who are going to benefit by this are those who've been investigated, nothing abnormal has been found, and then you move to treatment. So if someone's got blocked tubes or very little sperm, this is not going to work.
What is the actual next step if we were confirming this research and moving forward to implementing this in more cases? What's your next step?
I think the next step is to get the information out to patients and to doctors that for certain people this is a therapeutic option. And our whole aim in fertility medicine is to try and move away from IVF and get natural conceptions, because we think babies are better that way, and obviously it's much cheaper for families to be created that way.
Mm.
So a lot of it's to do with our now going out and working out the education. We don't want this to be used on people where IVF is absolutely necessary. And so we've got to work out some mechanism of informing the average general practitioner and gynecologist of the sort of patient who's going to benefit from it.
And that was Robert Norman, a professor of reproduction in the University of Adelaide. Much is being talked about currently of breastfeeding and the philosophy.
Hi, my name's Cara. I have 5 children. I attempted to breastfeed 2 of them.
Hi, I'm Cynthia. I'm a first-time mum to Ella. And I breastfed for 12 months.
This is Cara and Cynthia, 2 sisters from Sydney. It's safe to say that their children were not born with silver spoons in their mouths. We'll hear a bit more from the pair later on in the program, but first, how long should women breastfeed for?
When the World Health Organization looked at the evidence around babies' health and well-being, they recommended that babies in all countries should be exclusively breastfed for around 6 months, and then thereafter should continue to have breastfeeding alongside solids and other fluids up to at least age 2.
This is Mary Renfrew, Professor of Mother and Infant Health at the University of Dundee in Scotland. She is also a key technology partner at the University of Technology Sydney. Mary says people have latched on, excuse the pun, to the first half of this statement, the breastfeed exclusively for 6 months part, but ignore the other half.
And that's caused quite a problem because people think they should breastfeed 6 months and then stop. Actually, it's that exclusive breastfeeding, nothing but breast milk up to around 6 months and then ongoing. So quite a lot of people think that they should actually stop at 6 months. It's become almost a new norm.
In Australia, our breastfeeding rates are inadequate. We get off to a great start, but the drop-off rate is high. Susan Day is the Vice President of the Australian Breastfeeding Association and a volunteer breastfeeding counsellor.
In Australia, we have really good initiation rates, with about 96% of women starting to breastfeed. Sadly, the reality is, by 5 months, only about 15% of babies are being exclusively breastfed, and only 60% are receiving any breast milk. What this means is women want to breastfeed, but for various reasons are unable to continue to do so.
So over 90% of women start to breastfeed in hospital, but by the time the 5 to 6 month mark hits, only 15% of babies are exclusively breastfed, in line with the World Health Organization guidelines. And I should mention that those guidelines are strict. As soon as a baby has had one bottle of formula, they are no longer exclusively breastfed. Women generally stop breastfeeding in the first few weeks after leaving hospital. Some reports say over half of that 90% will have stopped breastfeeding 3 to 4 weeks after birth. Which brings us to the crux of this story. Why do women stop breastfeeding? Mary Renfrew again.
It's very influenced by socioeconomic background. There's an inequalities gradient, if you like, that more affluent women are much more likely to start and much more likely to continue to breastfeed. And women from poorer backgrounds are much less likely to start and much less likely to continue, which is, it's helping to continue the inequalities.
This is true in the United Kingdom, and it's also true in Australia. Breastfeeding rates are pretty consistent state to state, but suburb to suburb, it's a different story.
Yeah, particularly suburb to suburb. There tend to be, women who continue breastfeeding, usually are those who have a high intention to breastfeed, and often they have higher education and more capacity to get help with breastfeeding, more capacity to kind of manage their lives so that they can continue to breastfeed. So if they do have to return to work, they can manage that.
This is Lisa Amir, a GP and lactation consultant. She's also an associate professor at La Trobe University in Melbourne.
Whereas women, often in lower income areas, tend to be women who usually have a lower intention to breastfeed. And then it kind of becomes a bit self-fulfilling that they don't see women breastfeeding in their local area. They're more likely to have mothers who didn't breastfeed and, follow what they did and will say, well, you were formula fed, bottle fed, you were fine.
And this is, of course, backed up by statistics.
In the highest income group, 22% stopped by 4 months, and in the lowest income group, 40% stopped by 4 months.
A recent Australian study looked at 2,000 Australian women to find out what characteristics could predict that a woman would stop breastfeeding. Professor Julie Quinlifan was the lead author for that study, and she agrees that education, but also smoking levels, play a huge part.
So from the mother's point of view, mothers who smoke before pregnancy and also continue to smoke during pregnancy, and mothers with poorer levels of education, they're much more likely to start but then rapidly discontinue breastfeeding.
That full report can be found on our new website. And our music means we're out of time. You've been listening to Panacea on 107.3 2SER. This is your health program coming out every Tuesday evening. I'm Curtis Strawley. Coming up shortly will be A Question of Balance. So stay tuned. Have a great week.